This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. 2018 has been a hot, wet, and fiery summer around the world, from record temperatures in China to wildfires across the western United States, Sweden, and Greece, and devastating floods in India and Japan. Climate scientists are shouting from the rooftops, it's not just weather, it's climate change. But is the world listening? It sure doesn't feel like it. To understand why, let's go back in time. It's the 80s, and things sound a little different. And Americans have a lot on their minds.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The S&L crisis, some people say, well, it's going to bring down the whole U.S. economy.
Five men and two women who lost their lives on their way into space this morning.
Welcome to MTV Music Television.
But there's at least one thing that sounds eerily familiar.
There's a very real possibility that man, either through ignorance or indifference or both, is irreversibly altering the ability of our atmosphere to perform basic life support functions for our planet.
Republican Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island there sounding an alarm about climate change back in 1986, and he was hardly the first. Politicians on both sides of the aisle, scientists, and even the fossil fuel industry made the case to take climate change seriously, with calls growing louder beginning in the late 70s and early 80s.
Researchers say increasingly large amounts of CO2 are accumulating in the atmosphere. They fear the Earth will gradually become warmer, causing as yet uncertain but possibly disruptive changes in the Earth's climate 50 to 70 years from now.
One model of climate predicts that doubling carbon dioxide will result in August in Washington, D.C., that are 9 degrees centigrade warmer.
Goodbye, New Orleans. Goodbye, Charleston, Savannah, and Norfolk.
30, even 40 years ago, fears about man-made climate change leading to nothing short of a climate apocalypse were already taking hold, and the science was there.
One scientist put the urgency of the greenhouse potential in biblical terms, citing the warning given to Noah in the Old Testament. Noah knew trouble was coming, he said, and he prepared for it.
So if we knew the risks of a warming planet way back then, what happened? Nathaniel Rich is a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine, and he's behind a special issue dedicated entirely to the story of how we came so close to solving climate change in the 1980s and why efforts fell through, leaving us where we are today. Nathaniel, great to have you here in studio with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So, as we mentioned, hot-button political issue. First of all, by the way, the 80s seem like so long ago, but they weren't. What made you want to go back to the 80s to really start to unpack, or even, dare I say, 1979, to really start to unpack what happened here?
Yeah, well, essentially the story is a whodunit, with the question being, the mystery being, who prevented us from stopping serious, devastating climate change while there was still a great opportunity to do so. And in 1979, there was a strong scientific consensus. There were people within the government and outside of it who began to really push the issue and take it to the highest levels of the government, the agencies, and even the Oval Office. It wasn't a political, partisan issue. And their industry had not yet sunk its teeth in. And so there was a real opportunity. And over the course of the decade, a plan started to take place, which was the idea of a global treaty modeled after the ozone treaty, Montreal Protocol. And so I was fascinated to, first of all, to see how all of the conversations that we're having today were being had in 1980 identically, from everything from the threats to geoengineering. And I wanted to understand why this had happened and understand our failure. And it seemed to me a way to get at the story that moved beyond the kind of narratives that we've become paralyzed in.
And by 1979, I think one of the things that a lot of people will find surprising and probably not very heartening when they read your piece is that we already knew basically everything we know now then about global warming.
Yeah, there's a scientist named Ken Caldera in Stanford who I interviewed is one of the preeminent climate scientists, and he has this habit the beginning of every semester of asking his students, name what the largest advancements, the fundamental advancements in the science of climate change since 1979. And it's a trick question because there really haven't been any fundamental changes to our understanding of the science. There's been refinements.
If we've had the same information for almost 40 years now, what is the holdup? Is it politics?
I think politics have been the holdup, a big part of the holdup since the end of this period. 1989 is when it really starts to turn. But it seems to me that we tend to talk about it now as a political story or a science story or an economic or technology story. And really, it's a human story fundamentally. And I would say it's not even a human story, it's the human story. Our entire history, our quality of life has increased in step with our energy use. And that energy has been provided by coal, mainly oil and gas. And we've been borrowing from the future to pay those bills. And we owe a lot of debt now, and the bills come in. I think there's an important story to tell about industry's role in this since 1989, and it's been devastating role. And I think they will be remembered in history as perpetrating crimes against humanity, some of these disinformation efforts. But it's bigger than that.
And it's bigger than just the fossil fuel industry and coal industry. And it's actually, your reporting shows that industry was actually sort of on board with regulating these issues, right, and trying to do something about climate change.
There were earnest efforts, I think, in the early part of the decade to understand the science and engage with the issue in a serious way by some people within the industry and even some folks like the head of Exxon's research division in 1984 was speaking at symposiums held by Jim Hansen saying that Exxon was going to lead the transition to renewable energy. They might have been full of it at the time, but they certainly weren't engaging in this mass disinformation campaign that began at the end of the decade and turning their lobbyists against it and all of that.
So tell us, what were the turning points there? Because we go from having the information we have now, we've been with the same information essentially for 40 years. This sounded like it was a bipartisan or at least closer to a bipartisan effort to curb climate change. What were the turning points politically? When did this start to stop being about, a united effort to protect the planet and then suddenly becoming something that's just so politicized we can barely talk about it?
Well, there was a trajectory through the decade of progress. And by the end of the decade, you have George Bush, one, running in his campaign saying that, those who think we will struggle to cure the greenhouse effect haven't heard about the White House effect. And when I'm in the White House, we're gonna solve it.
And let me tell you how I would lead as president. I would start by integrating environmental considerations into all policy decisions, from foreign to farm to economic policy, from the education of our children to research and development of our scientists. And I'd immediately begin to address some of the major challenges that confront us.
He takes office, and the first negotiations for a framework for a global treaty start to take place. His chief of staff, John Sununu, PhD engineer, deeply skeptical of the science and has some kind of conspiratorial theories about environmental movement using this as a way to attack economic growth. And he wins an internal battle within the White House against people like William Riley, who's the head of Bush's EPA, who were very strongly supporting a treaty. And so that's the beginning of the turn. The U.S. refuses to endorse specific emissions reductions. And then industry starting to pay attention. And by the time you get to the Rio Earth Summit in 92, it's basically too late. The White House has turned against it. Bush has no interest in pursuing it. And industry starts spending massively on campaigns to defeat any kind of emissions reductions proposals.
We knew about the risks of climate change decades ago, and we even came close to real efforts to combat it. And that's what Nathaniel Rich is telling us in his new piece that makes up the entirety of the latest New York Times magazine. Nathaniel, we're talking about the political shift, but what's the business shift? When did industry say, this, as you call it, misinformation campaign is going to be the way to go. Were we really trying to just protect industry here?
It basically starts in 88 after Jim Hansen gives this famous now testimony before Congress.
And Jim Hansen is, of course, a well-known scientist and became one of the main voices speaking out about climate change. And let's listen to a bit of his testimony before Congress in 1988.
Altogether, this evidence represents a very strong case, in my opinion, that the greenhouse effect has been detected and it is changing our climate now.
That sort of perks up the ears of industry, which has tuned out of the issue for a number of years. And they start to hold meetings at American Petroleum Institute, and Exxon senior research folks start to talk with their public relations staff. And they start to prepare position papers that quickly become the kind of default line for the industry. But they're still in a kind of reactive mode in this period. And so it's only once they start to see real policy coming forward and the real threat of action on regulations that they start to combat it more viciously. But I think 88, 89, they become aware, they start to formulate a position of you know, let's make sure that the science is as good as it can be, let's emphasize uncertainty, and then within a year or two, it's on to the pure disinformation.
So things start to fall apart. You're arguing that that was an opportunity for us collectively as a country and as potentially as a global society to change. Now, that change hasn't happened. Where do we stand today?
Well, we've emitted more greenhouse gases since the end of that decade globally than we did before it in the history of humanity. So things are going very violently in the wrong direction. I think even the IPCC and even people like Jim Hansen now are saying that the only way to get a handle on this is to do some kind of massive geoengineering or technological solutions to remove carbon dioxide. It's not enough to slow the pace of growth, but we have to get to negative emissions.
Are we at a place where we can depoliticize this issue? Because this is seemingly the problem, that it has become politicized and it's become less about humanity and more about politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of debate within the environmental movement, especially about how to talk about this problem. And there's been a kind of orthodoxy that says we need to express hope and we need to tell people that there's a lot of good news, and there is a lot of good news happening. The problem is the scale at which it's happening is not nearly sufficient. And my feeling about all that is that I think it's important first to have an honest conversation about where we are, the hole that we're in now, and the degree to which not only, you know, we're all affected, but how we got here together as a species. And I think that reckoning hasn't started yet, but I'm hoping that it will begin soon.
I think your piece will definitely help start that conversation. Nathaniel Rich is a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine, and the latest issue of the magazine is entirely dedicated to this story, Losing Earth, the decade we almost stopped climate change, a tragedy in two acts. Nathaniel, thank you.
Thank you.
For more than 5 years, a gun rights advocate named Cody Wilson has been trying to publish an online blueprint for how to print 3D guns. And today, he was supposed to prevail. But yesterday, a federal judge issued an order blocking the company, Defense Distributed, from publishing their plans, citing irreparable harm. There will be a follow-up hearing to the matter on August 10th. Connecticut Attorney General George Jepson is part of a multi-state lawsuit brought by 8 states and the District of Columbia against the Trump administration for allowing Defense Distributed and the company's founder, Cody Wilson, to release those blueprints.
The core issue is that these guns, they're plastic, are untraceable and virtually undetectable. They're the ideal weapon for someone who, say, wants to get through airport security to hijack an airplane. The Obama administration back in 2013, under federal law, prohibited the dissemination of the blueprints and plans for making these guns. It was challenged in court by Wilson and his Defense Distributed organization. They lost at the trial level. The Trump administration picked up the lawsuit and did the right thing and continued to prohibit dissemination of these plans and blueprints, and prevailed at the appellate court level, the Supreme Court did not take up the case, which meant the government won. Then in this startling, bizarre about-face, the Trump administration a few months ago secretly negotiated a deal that basically handed the victory that the government had won and gave Defense Distributed and Cody Wilson everything that they wanted, plus their legal fees. And so we state attorneys general are in court essentially saying, no, that the federal law should prevail, and these plans and blueprints should not be disseminated. And last night we got the temporary restraining order that we sought.
Last night we did get a temporary restraining order. However, some of these plans or these blueprints actually went up last Friday, and they've already been downloaded a couple thousand times. And some of the plans are available on another website. Given that they're out there, is that ruling effective?
And it's very regrettable that 1,500 or so individuals have downloaded those plans. We can't stop that, but we can take steps, and the TRO from last night's court ruling is the first step in that process in preventing widespread distribution of these plans. So, yes, I regret that 1,500 or so individuals have downloaded those plans, but the more we can limit their distribution in the future, the better.
And also, Attorney General, there are some folks who say that these guns are not completely undetectable, that they will require some metal parts potentially. Does that even matter? Is that even on the radar at this point for you all?
I'm not saying they're completely undetectable. It's also possible to make a somewhat primitive gun that has very limited metal parts, or that could allow dismantling and then reassembly after the point of entry, so that the metal tube, for example, that would be the gun barrel, it just becomes a metal tube in somebody's bag, and a short metal tube, and doesn't look like a gun, it's just a metal tube. And then you get beyond security and you reassemble the weapon.
So Cody Wilson, who we've actually reached out to, and we reached out to Defense Distributed for this specific piece, we have not gotten a response yet to our request. But Cody Wilson is saying that the State Department infringed on his First Amendment right to free speech and his Second Amendment rights by forcing him to take down the blueprints. Your position on that, Attorney General?
Yes, he litigated those issues and he lost. There's no right under the Constitution that's completely unlimited. You can't obviously scream fire in a crowded theater when there's no fire. No freedom under the Bill of Rights is without limits.
George Jepson is the Attorney General for the state of Connecticut. Attorney General Jepson, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Earlier this week, Cody Wilson, the founder of Defense Distributed, tweeted, quote, "I am now being sued by at least 21 state attorneys general. If you want your Second Amendment online, this is the fight." But our next guest makes the case that this fight is as much about the First Amendment as it is about the Second. Ilya Shapiro supports Cody Wilson's efforts to publish the blueprints, and he joins us today to explain why. Ilya is a senior fellow in constitutional studies for the Cato Institute. Ilya, thank you for joining us.
Good to be on.
So your reaction to last night's news, the federal judge ruling that blocks the further publishing of these blueprints?
Yeah, this is the only judge that has ruled in this way. There have been several others. There was an attempt to intervene in Texas when that lawsuit was winding down, when the settlement was being ratified between the federal government and Cody Wilson and Defense Distributed. They rushed to the court in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. All of those judges ruled against the state, and this one judge in Washington ruled the other way. So this could ultimately go to the Supreme Court on the question of nationwide injunctions, which has been an issue in a lot of different policy areas. But that's kind of an issue for a later day. On specifically this case, this is a First Amendment case because this is not about distributing weapons or the ability to manufacture your own 3D plastic guns to sell or give away to other people. This is about the files being put online. And as Attorney General Jepson acknowledged, these files have already been online for a long time, not just Cody Wilson's, but if you Google megapacks, if you Google 3D plastic gun blueprints, you can find a lot of stuff. They're not hosted on U.S. servers because of this ongoing litigation, but you can find it, and it's not illegal, and you're not violating any sort of laws by looking at it.
Well, the Attorney General also did say that there is no right that's completely unlimited, including the First Amendment and as well as the Second Amendment. And in their counter to this, they're saying that they're doing this essentially to have with public safety in mind. What's your response to that?
Well, sure. But courts have ruled that even publishing blueprints to a nuclear weapon is not illegal. The only thing that's illegal is publishing classified material and other things that are protected by law. I mean, there's lots of things that are so-called dangerous, but as long as it's information, as long as it's pure speech, we allow it to be published. The First Amendment provides very broad protection. And certainly prior restraints, as the technical jargon goes, are very rare in American case law. So this ruling by this judge is a blip. I mean, eventually this will get reversed and the settlement will go forth. It's an odd sort of lawsuit because if you read the judge's ruling, it's really directed towards the Trump administration, not towards Cody Wilson. It's saying you went through the wrong procedure in not requiring Mr. Wilson to get a certain type of license or subjecting him to the types of controls regarding defense articles, essentially calling him an international weapons trafficker. It's an odd posture for this lawsuit and certainly not something that states can or should be involved in.
Ilya, I'm curious, though. I mean, we're talking here about the attorneys general are saying that they're attempting to remove from the internet the information that they're trying to take offline is used to manufacture weapons. So my question is, I can't buy Sudafed or sinus medication without having to go through some sort of control at the pharmacy. Should we not draw a line regarding blueprints for these firearms?
Well, look, can you buy information about what Sudafed is made out of? Absolutely. Creating drugs that are illegal is illegal, but possessing the information about how to do it is not and cannot be restrained. And what we're talking about here are plastic weapons that aren't very useful, and it would be really expensive and hard to make something that would be some sort of public safety a problem. If criminals want to access weapons, there's a lot easier, faster, more efficient, cheaper way of doing so than trying to create these 3D guns. Unless you're using some sort of smelting operation in a very complicated, expensive printer that uses metal, it can't be done.
Ilya Shapiro, Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
All last week, leaders in the global health community met in Amsterdam for the 22nd International AIDS Conference. And on Tuesday's program, we heard from a science advisor for UNAIDS on efforts to fight the epidemic globally. But within the United States, the HIV epidemic still rages on, especially among specific subgroups of the population. If the current trends continue, one in two Black gay men is expected to be diagnosed with HIV in their lifetimes. And that's compared to one in 99 Americans overall who will contract the virus. And according to estimates from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, 56% of Black transgender women are living with HIV. Tori Cooper is an HIV consultant and prevention specialist at a health center outside of Atlanta, and she's also a trans woman who helps target outreach to other trans women. Tori, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Tanzina.
So we know that the state of Georgia has one of the highest rates of HIV infection in any state. What does it look like on the ground from the work that you're doing?
So HIV is a huge epidemic across the world, but especially here in the South. I speak as a Black trans woman who lives here in the South, and what we're seeing is really institutionalized separatism and racism that really is affecting our overall health. It's affecting the way that we earn money. It's affecting our life expectancy. It affects the way that we access care and that we manipulate ourselves through the healthcare system. So it's really, really horrible. It looks very much like it did in 1989 versus 2018. So 20 years ago, as far as the healthcare system in Atlanta and even across the country.
What is driving that? Because you said 1989, and I remember, you know, growing up in that era where AIDS and HIV had just started to come to the surface and how difficult it was in that era. What do you think is driving the current rates of HIV infection in the communities that you're working with?
So there are a number of different drivers, some of which, you wrote a great article titled, Where's the Empathy for Black Poverty and Pain? And some of the issues that you addressed in that article are some of the issues that we see in the trans community. There's homophobia, there's transphobia, and those are two things that are keeping people out of care. We're seeing systematic oppression. We're seeing where systems and healthcare systems really aren't addressing the social determinants of health. That's poverty, that's homeless, that's lower education and literacy levels. And, you know, as Black trans people, on average, we earn less than $10,000 a year. So we have to add that in as another factor as well. Some people just don't have the money to get back and forth to doctor's appointments, or they may not have the health literacy to be able to know, well, when I come back in 6 months, does that mean 6 months from today, or does that mean 6 months from when I first got my diagnosis? You know, there are a bunch of different factors that play in, and our current healthcare system doesn't really address all of those different things. Instead, it just kind of assumes you know how to manage it, and that's an assumption that's costing people's lives.
I also, I'm curious about two things. You mentioned the literacy around this, and I wonder if we are at a point where HIV is something that's considered a manageable disease these days, and because of the medications that we have, you mentioned the magical antiviral load. Is there not enough literacy, or is there not enough public education about the dangers of HIV, about the transmission of HIV, about the need to be tested? Like, is there just not that conversation happening enough at the public level?
So literacy and health literacy are similar, but two different things. So when it comes to first literacy and literature, trans people, we often aren't represented in marketing campaigns. We still see commercials that are mostly white, cisgender men, and pretty much across the board in marketing. And that's not who the epidemic prioritizes anymore. The fastest rates of new infections aren't among white men. And so what we need to see is we need to see marketing campaigns that represent who the fastest and most impacted groups are. And then on the health literacy side, for a person who may know their diagnosis, being able to read a bottle and know the difference between take with food and take with a meal is what we call health literacy. And for some people, that can be more of a challenge than actually taking the one pill a day. You know, everybody's not on a one pill a day regimen.
Well, let's talk about those pills, though,
yes.
Because I feel like, at least in New York, we've been seeing a lot of advertising on the subways and on buses for the drug PrEP. Is the community able to access drugs like PrEP or PEP? And for our listeners who don't know what these are, PrEP is a pill that people with high risk of exposure to HIV can take to prevent them from contracting the disease. And PEP is a drug that you can take after you've been exposed.
So your question, is there access? And
right.
Yes, there is access. The thing is that a lot of trans people don't know that it's for them. And we hear every day people saying, well, I'm not going to take PrEP because I'm not going to be able to afford it. Because we're not doing a great job. That's not just us, but that's across the board. We're not doing a great job of letting people know that for some people, they may not have to pay for PrEP at all. So we don't make sure to get the message out to people. And look at the thing of PEP, P-E-P, post-exposure prophylaxis. We don't make sure that people understand that if you have potentially come in contact with HIV, you have 72 hours to get on PEP, and it could keep you from ever getting HIV, even if you've had unprotected sex. We're doing a horrible job at delivering those messages to people, especially the people who can benefit the most from it.
I'm wondering, Tori, before we wrap up, when you look out at the landscape going forward, are there any opportunities for success?
So there are a number of bright spots, and there are still many more opportunities for success. Bright spots are when people tell me, so I went to the doctor and I had my 6-month checkup and I'm undetectable. That's amazing, because what undetectable viral loads mean is that that person cannot pass HIV along to their sexual partners. And so if we could get every person who has HIV to an undetectable viral load consistently, what it does is it means nobody can pass HIV along. And that's how one of the ways that we could see an end to the HIV epidemic. So every time I hear those small victories, it is a big victory against HIV.
Tori Cooper is an HIV prevention specialist at a healthcare center in Georgia. Tori, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been my honor.
As part of our week-long look at the intersection of race, place, and health with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, we turn today to public housing in New York City, a clear example that where you live has a big impact on your health. Late last week, New York City's Department of Investigation launched a probe into the breakdown in communication between the Health Department and the New York City Public Housing Authority over blood lead levels in children. It's the latest development in a story that ultimately revealed that 820 children in public housing under the age of 6 have tested positive for elevated levels of lead between 2012 and 2016. Further investigation found that the Housing Authority, better known as NYCHA here in New York, had failed to perform required lead paint inspections for years, despite claiming to be in compliance. Greg B. Smith, the investigative reporter at the New York Daily News who broke the story on lead paint exposure, says the city took more than a year to recognize the scope of the lead problem.
Until I wrote the story about 820 children, they have this number that they were walking around with about the number of apartments that likely have lead paint. The number was 55,000. This is what they said. So after that story came out, they suddenly changed the number. And now it's 130,000. I mean, if you don't look at something, then it's not a problem, right?
So how did families living across 130,000 apartments end up getting exposed to poison? Greg Smith explains just how important the public housing system is to New York.
It's the biggest landlord in the city of New York. It's the largest housing authority in America, by far, by the way. 400,000 residents live in actual NYCHA developments. There's another approximately 200,000 that receive Section 8 housing. And there is working people live there. This is another thing that drives me crazy about people talking about public housing. They don't even understand what it is, frankly. They're working people, and these are people who like work at the airport or they work at the post office. It's an incredibly important part of this city because there is a dearth of affordable housing. And if you let something like this basically fall apart, then you're doing a number on the ability for middle class and lower middle class people to be able to live in the city of New York. And that's very important because otherwise all you have is extremely poor people and extremely wealthy people living in a city. And that's not good for anybody.
So your investigation uncovered what specifically about lead paint in NYCHA developments?
Well, my investigation started out by looking at kids who had tested for elevated levels of blood lead. And what was kind of disturbing to me was when I started to write about this, which was in 2015, the Housing Authority's position was none of these kids are really being harmed. There's a couple of kids. That's about it. Plus, we have a vigorous program to go after lead paint, and we're always monitoring it and always inspecting. At the time that I was writing this stuff, they knew that what they were saying was a lie. At that point, they had stopped doing inspections, annual inspections, which are required by law and also by the federal regulations of apartments for lead paint. In addition to that, they had decided that they were not going to embrace the standard that the federal government uses when determining what level of lead in a child's blood is considered to be of concern. The Centers for Disease Control has this standard of 5 micrograms per deciliter. But they knew, and that, by the way, includes the mayor, knew at that time that they were not on top of the situation.
And you're talking about Mayor Bill de Blasio.
That's correct.
And at the time, NYCHA, the head of NYCHA was Shola Oyatole, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's right. And ultimately, the United States Attorney gets involved in this. They were looking at what NYCHA has filed with the federal government, because they're required every single year to file what's called an annual plan, and it has to swear that these conditions are habitable. So they're looking at these documents, and all of these documents are saying everything is fine. So when I go in and I start telling them, well, not really. I mean, there's these kids out there with lead poisoning that they deny have anything to do with the NYCHA's conditions. Then there's also the other issues of mold and multiple other problems in this place. And so the U.S. attorney starts to really go after the falsification of documents inside this agency.
Let's talk about a little bit about the impact and the people affected by this, right? Outside of the mayor and the federal government, can you give us a sense of what public housing residents are saying, what their kids are going through, the kids who've been poisoned by lead paint?
Sure. Centers for Disease Control uses the 5-microgram standard, but the Centers for Disease Control says basically any level of lead is not good. But if you have a concentration of 5 or more, then you are now in a situation where your child is probably going to have developmental delays. It's impossible to make that stop other than to get them out of that situation. So a lot of the kids that I've interviewed and talked to have had this problem. They've been put into special ed. To me, it seems almost crazy because, in a way, it's government neglect channels these kids into this situation that now the government has to deal with. The other part of this that's really disturbing to me is that unless the doctor calls up the health department, right, says the child has a level of 5, the health department would not inspect the apartment because they had decided that their standard, the city of New York, was 10 micrograms. That's what the 820 kids is. That's 820 kids where they didn't go in and test the apartment because they made a decision that they were going to use a different standard than the one that the federal government says is a cause for concern.
What is the federal government's response to this case of almost 900 children being poisoned?
The federal government is entered into a consent decree with the city and with NYCHA. And the consent decree is an agreement in which the housing authority agrees that it's okay to have a federal monitor come in and oversee their compliance. That's what the idea of this is. So to make sure that they're in compliance with lead paint inspection rules and regulations, also mold, elevators, all of these things. But it has to be approved by a federal judge. And they had a hearing a couple weeks ago, and the federal judge was extremely skeptical about this because you need to be able to enforce things. You can't just say, well, we intend to clean up the lead or we intend to clean up the mold. You have to have a way to enforce that and to really make sure that it's actually happening. That remains to be seen. I don't know how that's going to play out, but it is a good thing because it's the first time they've had real oversight.
As I mentioned before we started the interview, we're looking at the intersection of race, place, and health. And when you think about the connection of where you're born and the health outcomes you're likely to experience, what does your reporting on this issue in New York City's public housing tell you about that connection between zip code and destiny?
There's a total connection. It has everything to do with where you are in society. And if you are in an upper middle class neighborhood, the birth rate situation is much healthier. The level of cigarette smoking is less, and there's certainly less exposure to lead paint. There is a total connection between being poor and being unhealthy.
Greg B. Smith is an investigative reporter at the New York Daily News. Thank you, Greg.
You bet.
And that's our show for today. You can always find us on Facebook, Twitter, or call us anytime at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.